Blog Talk Radio.
Monstrex Radio brings you The Haunted Sea with host Scott Martis.
Hello, welcome to another episode of The Haunted Sea. I'm your host, Scott Martis. Our guest today is science author and cryptozoology enthusiast Matt Billy. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Scott.
I thought I would just read your bio that you sent me. Probably the easiest way to get the information out. So I'll read from that. Matt Billy is a naturalist, historian, and writer in Colorado Springs. A former Air Force officer, he was lead author of the NASA-published history, The First Space Race, Launching the World's First Satellites. He wrote two well-received books on unknown animals, Rumors of Existence, 1995, and Shadows of Existence, 2006. His third focuses on marine animals and legends. He's published one creature thriller, The Dolmen, and a fantasy, Raven Quest, and he's polishing a scientific thriller based on legends of Lake Iliamna. He has broad interest, having written articles and papers on topics ranging from whale tracking to Martian soil, and creating the top site on the prehistoric predator Dunkleosteus terrellae, a species he wrote about for prehistoric times. He appeared on two TV shows on mystery animals and blogs on the latest science and technology news at Matt's SciTech blog. He is a member of the National Association of Science Writers and the Society for Marine Mammalogy. Blog, www.mattbilly.com. blogspot.com, website www.mattbilly.com, and Dunkleosteus page www.facebook.com/dunkleosteusterrellae/. Well, hello, Matt. Thank you for coming on the show. And why don't we start by talking about this third cryptozoology book you're working on about sea creatures?
Okay. Yeah, there was so much interesting sea material I never used about new discoveries and oddities that I decided my third book was going to focus on that. And I told everybody some years ago that this book was going to be out in 2014. But you keep finding new discoveries and you keep thinking, well, that's got to go in, that's got to go out. Plus, you detour to work on articles and novels and stuff. And what I call sea sharks and serpents is still probably only about half done, but I will get there.
Yeah, take your time. I'm sure it'll be great when it comes out. I read your first book, and I thought it was very good.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I've also read The Dolmen.
How'd you like that?
Oh, I thought it was fine. Kind of reminded me, sort of flavored like the TV movie Gargoyles. Sort of a spin on that.
Oh, I remember that. That was a good movie.
Yeah. Well, how did you become such an enthusiast for Dunkleosteus? Tell us about that.
You know, I'm not sure I can really date it. It wasn't 10 years ago. I wasn't, it was just another cool species, but I happened to start poking into researching it both for fiction and nonfiction, and discovered that there's a lot, not a lot written outside of scientific papers, and there's not even as many scientific papers as you would expect to find on, you know, the great apex predator of the whole Devonian era. So I kind of threw myself into it the last few years. I think 5 years ago I created the Facebook page, and there's 2,000 people liking that. So that is really, really cool. I did an article summer 2018, I think, in Prehistoric Times magazine, where I talked to really all the top four or five people, phone or email, that that study this creature. And the knowledge is still evolving. It's like a shark where the skeleton is cartilage. And you're very lucky if you get something besides that head and that front armor. So it's a creature we don't know much about, given its prominence and time. It had the heaviest armor, you know, that any fish has ever carried. It had the biggest tooth-like structures, probably, that a fish has ever carried. And it's just fascinating that this, you know, I called it the first king of the oceans in the Prehistoric Times article. And it's just fascinating how you can find new analysis on it all the time. Not a lot, as I said. There's not a lot written there, and certainly not a lot for a non-scientist audience. But it's just fascinating, and I think I have the biggest collection of different models and toys and books and so on that I know of on it. Always looking to add more.
I know of three related genera. There's Dunkelosteus, Dinictus, and Titanictus. What is the difference between them? Do you know?
Yeah. Dunkelosteus is at least 10 species. It used to be within Dinictus. They were synonymous for a while. Dinictus is still a valid genus, but with only one species in it. The other one, our friend the Titan there, was a close relative, but it may have fed, it may have been a filter feeder rather than a monster hunter killer.
Now, for years now, you've been working on a book based on the idea that Dunkelosteus survived in Lake Eliamna, and you actually sent me a draft copy of one of the older versions. Is that still in the works?
That is still in the works. I am, as I like to say, cannonading the ramparts of agents and publishers. You know, it is going to come out. It was fascinating to take these two threads, because I'd written nonfiction about the giant fish stories from Lake Eliamna, which is certainly one of the most solid, quote, lake monster, unquote, stories in the world. And I'd studied this animal, and if you think about it, several lineages survived the extinction events. The sharks did, and the coelacanths did, and the bony fish did, and the lampreys and whatever else you put with them in whatever hell they came from. So saying one more species survived, you can sort of draw some plausibility in there. And that was a lot of fun.
Well, getting down to the real facts and what we have to work with that we know about at this point, what do you think about the idea that the Eliamna monsters could be white sturgeons?
In my opinion, that is probably what they are. There's never been a sturgeon caught there. There's been one down in the fairly close in Bristol Bay, I think, which is on the Gulf of Alaska. I suspect that a population, has to be a small one, has maybe gotten a little cut off and tends to produce very big individuals. Even if you round off for exaggeration, and, you know, the usual mistakes. Take the claims of 20 feet down to 15, and so that's at the top end of white sturgeon. And I think it's likely that it will sooner or later, something will drift ashore, something will get caught in the net, and that's likely what it is. The although that's not, you know, that's not absolutely certain. There's a lot of interesting sightings in there, and the there are underwater camera experiments. There's at least one that I know of going on now. But you never know what it could be, and that's, of course, where the fiction comes in. A fellow named Pat Poe, who was the salmon biologist for that lake, told me, "I don't understand why there isn't a bigger predator in that lake." Yes!
So in other words, the food potential is there for...
It's seasonal, but it's
predator.
There.
Yeah, okay. So theoretically, there's enough food there that there ought to be some larger predator feeding on it.
It's the biggest salmon run in the world, and though of course it's spring and summer, you have the if you hypothesized a predator that sort of lived a low energy lifestyle like sleeper sharks do part of the year, and then was active with the mating and the egg bearing and so forth, or live bearing or whatever, during the months when the food is plenty, it kind of works out. So
well,
it's very intriguing.
There was a scientist, marine biologist associated with Lake Iliamna, that was credited as starting the idea of lake monsters being Greenland sharks. I can't remember his name.
Well, Jeremy Wade suggested it on his TV show. I remember that.
This is before Jeremy Wade. This is like maybe 7-8 years ago. I remember the guy's first name was Bruce, and I can't remember his last name.
Champagne.
No, not Bruce Champagne. This guy is a fisheries biologist up at Lake Iliamna. And I can't remember his last name. Let me see if I can find it online. Hang on a second here.
Okay, I don't think I've heard that.
How long have they known that there were an indigenous population of seals in Lake Iliamna?
You know, we've known for a long time. I mean, the natives hunted them long before white people came. It was only, I think, in the last 30 years, I'd have to look up the paper, it's somewhere in these stacks of papers, 10, 15 years ago maybe, that they established that this was a resident population. They weren't coming in and out through the Quechac River.
Well, that certainly gives credence to the idea there might be something else unknown in there.
Yeah, okay, Bruce Wright. Got it.
There you go. Yeah, Bruce Wright.
Anchorage Daily News.
Yeah, there you go. I knew. I just couldn't remember his last name.
I have that, you know, somewhere in my mess of stuff on the lake, but I don't think I've ever contacted him. Actually, I've got to remedy that. I need to talk to him.
Yeah, well, one thing I've noticed about the reports from Lake Iliamna, they seem to have the recurring thing of large dorsal fins on a fish-like animal. And neither the Greenland shark nor the white sturgeon have that prominent dorsal fin in the middle of the back like that. That's an unusual thing regarding the reports from Lake Iliamna.
Well, it's a mix. That shows up sometimes, and sometimes it's more of a hump thing or a serrated thing. Sturgeon would be good suspects for serrated. You're right, the sleeper sharks tend to have low dorsals. So, you know, the reports that mention that put a little extra mystery into it.
Yeah. So, of the reports from Lake Iliamna, which are your favorite individual reports that you find the most impressive?
Let's see. One that I had missed completely was in Wade's TV show. He had an interview clip there with an anthropologist who was flying over the lake and saw something like a giant sturgeon. I had not heard of that particular witness before. I talked to a bush pilot named Tim LaPorte, and I'm sure you've heard that name in connection with it. And he described it as 12 to 14 feet based on a boat he was familiar with seeing. And one of his passengers was supposedly a fish and game official from Michigan, although I don't think we have that name. But talking to him, the last thing he remembered after the splash was seeing this big vertical tail, you know, sweeping side to side, sort of slow and majestic, which is really, really cool.
I just brought up a timeline history of the sightings.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like the earliest one is from 1942.
Yes. Some of the bush pilots and reportedly Navy pilots who were flight training over there reported something of the sort. Babe Allsworth.
Yep, that's the name listed here.
Yeah, I saw a school over 10 feet long. It's funny that the color he mentioned, he described it as looking like dull aluminum. It's surprising that turns up once or twice more.
Well, that sounds like the coloration of some kind of salmonid.
Could be.
And we know from the fossil record there were really giant salmonids during the middle part and later part of the Age of Mammals before the Ice Age. So there's another possibility, less remote, you could have some kind of surviving relic giant salmonid is a possibility too.
Yeah, the interesting thing about Iliamna, and you know, about 10 years ago, I decided to write a novel that took one of my favorite genres, the prehistoric survival thriller. And of course, you know about that. And said, okay, real people, real science, what's something that hasn't been done before? And Iliamna, and I looked around quite a bit, Iliamna is the only place in the world that seemed plausible. You've got 900 feet deep, you've got 1,000 square miles, you've got a population, permanent population of only several hundred residents scattered around this thing. There's no road. You know, it's just pretty much in the middle of nowhere. And if there's a giant fish anywhere in the world that we haven't found, that's kind of the perfect place for it to be.
So most of the population around the lake are indigenous people?
Yes. There's a mix of Tlingit and Dena'ina and Yupik around the lake. Very, very few white people until the last couple of decades.
And they're very heavily subsistent on a maritime existence out of the lake for food?
Oh, yeah. Fishing in the lake is one of the main industries, both for the local people and, of course, for the tourists who fly in, the sport fishermen who fly in. There is plenty of other game around Lake Iliamna. Yeah. There's caribou and so forth for those who like that.
What fish are the sports fishermen primarily fishing for?
Well, the fishermen, sports fishermen, like to come in the summer when the king salmon are running. That's everybody's favorite. But you've got all four species, I believe, of American salmon in there. Plus, there's char and rainbow trout.
Yeah.
That can be worth your while. It's really a pretty amazing place. The only thing that keeps it from being overrun is, again, the remoteness, the fact that you have to pretty much have to fly in, which is expensive, of course.
Are there any cases of belugas getting into the lake?
Yes, there have been some historical beluga sightings. I don't know when the last one was. It's not a regular thing.
Yeah.
But they have shown up.
Yeah, well, that happens up in the St. Lawrence River close to Lake Champlain, too. There was one that swam all the way to Montreal. So, beyond Lake Iliamna, are there any other lake monster reports that you give credence to that you find somewhat compelling or interesting?
Iliamna is the only one where I would personally bet money on something being there. The other, you know, the major monster lakes, I guess you might call them, Okanagan and Champlain, you know, there's enough sightings to wonder a little bit about, you know, whether there's at least a fish bigger than you thought in there.
At least in Champlain, we do have a population of resident lake sturgeons that are known to get 7 feet long. So, you know, if you had a couple of outsized lake sturgeon, might be a potential answer.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the more compelling sea serpent reports, like the Valhalla monster. Give us your take on that.
Well, that's a really fun subject, you know, whether we ever find anything or not. It's, you know, the quote sea serpent unquote, which everybody agrees is not a serpent, but hey, it sticks. The gold standard was that sighting 115 years ago by the two British naturalists, Nicole and Mead Waldo, off Brazil. And the drawings they did at the time of what's either a long neck or a long forebody held well out of the water with a prominent dorsal, it doesn't exactly match anything, but the report is so good that it's really, really hard to see how they could have been mistaken. And if you, you know, sometimes I think if that one report was definitively explained, I would give up the whole business.
Mm-hmm.
But as it is, I can't help wondering if there's a big eel or eel-like fish still down there among the sea serpent data.
Yeah, well, the Valhalla monster, the two best answers, if you take the report at face value that I could come up with, is some kind of plesiosaurish-like turtleish reptile or a giant fat-bodied eel of some sort.
Yeah, and of course, we all love plesiosaurs. We'd all love it if they were alive, but they did manage to, you know, drop out of the fossil record without leaving anything we found. So I'm not inclined to believe that they are still around, as much as I'd like to be wrong.
Well, the three answers that have been put forward by the skeptics to explain away the Valhalla monster are, first, you had Richard Ellis's idea of a giant squid holding its tentacle up out of the water. Then you had the idea of a thermoregulating sea lion with its flipper up in the air to look like a dorsal fin. And then the latest explanation that's come along is some kind of a sea turtle with fishing gear attached to it, which might explain the dorsal fin. So, personally, I find none of those explanations adequate to explain it away, but that's just my opinion.
Yeah, I don't like any of those. I corresponded with Ellis some, and yes, if a squid did that, it could look very much like a monster at the right angle. But there doesn't seem to be any possible reason for a squid to do that. I think the sea turtle, yeah, it just seems to me they would have recognized that. You know, they said they had a very good look through binoculars. And the seal, well, the dorsal fin's all wrong. It's kind of squarish.
Yeah.
You know, or like a ribbon on the back. So, you know, the big thing against the Valhalla report is there's nothing else as good. You know, yeah, in all the years before and since. But it's yeah, still there.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, oh, what was I thinking of? I lost my train of thought here. Hang on a minute. Well, I lost my thought there. But I know you've done some research on the infamous Pensacola Sea Monster attack. What is your opinion on that, and what has your research led you to think about that?
Well, gosh, corresponded once with a relative of one of the boys who said they all believed this was accurate. I don't ever like to accuse a man of lying unless I know he's lying or I know him. So I'm hesitant to call Mr. McCleary a liar, but I don't believe that this happened the way he's describing it. You have to assume that you had a fish that looked, or you know, a creature that behaved in a way that such creatures have never been reported to behave, if that makes sense, you know.
Yeah.
And there's some things in the report itself I don't like. He gives a sort of a good description of the head, despite it being pitch dark with no light sources. I really don't think we're going to find evidence for that one.
Well, McCleary died in 2016. I am still in touch with his son, and his son doesn't know too much about it. So,
well, it wasn't in any of the original reports to the Coast Guard or the media.
Yeah,
it only cropped up some years later, I think, in Fate magazine.
Yeah, so, 3 years after the event. But the whole drowning part, that is verified from the newspaper.
Oh yeah, yeah, it
it's
is
just sea monster aspect of it that's in question. So we don't know what really happened. Obviously something traumatic happened, and he may have been under stress and panic, and hysteria may have led to him to partially hallucinate something, or maybe they were attacked by a bull shark or some other similar animal, and maybe he just, from the traumatic stress of it, misremembered bits and pieces of it. I don't know, you know?
That's possible.
There's entirely the possibility that he believed it was true in
yes,
his mind. So I don't know. I mean, I will say this. There are reports of anomalous long-necked creatures in that whole stretch of the Panhandle. And I'm sure you're aware of some of those, too.
Yeah, and some off the East Coast, off the St. John's
River,
too.
Yeah, all up and down the St. John's River. And then you had that weird carcass that was supposedly found around 1880, the New River Inlet carcass. That could have been a basking shark or a mutilated whale. We just don't know, but it certainly had a large body and what looked like a long neck with a missing head. So I don't know, you know.
Right, and you know the little joke Mother Nature plays on us with basking sharks and the way they decay so that they don't look like the original shark at all.
Yeah.
They look like a long neck thing.
Well, I think you did a blog on the Zio Maru carcass, and because I had an open mind on the Zio Maru carcass, you accidentally assumed I was a creationist. I wasn't angry. I was just,
I
thought it was hilarious.
Did I do that?
Yeah. You don't remember that?
I'm sorry if yeah, no, I don't remember it.
I thought it was hilarious that you would think it just because I took up from the Zuya Maru carcass that I was a creationist. But
yeah, I must have conflated you with someone else. That's all I can think. So I apologize. Correct.
That's all right. It's our water under the bridge. You corrected it. So, but you know, if you really read the scientific papers on the Zuya Maru carcass, there were a few holdouts that said, hey, wait a minute, this might not be a basket shark.
Yeah, it was basically one guy,
two or three. There's this paleontologist, Yoshinori Imizumi. Oh, no, wait a minute. Oh, God, their names, I always get them mixed up. Anyway, there's one of them that was a paleontologist that specialized in plesiosaurs. And at the end of his paper, he said, there is no definitive evidence to decide whether this was a shark or an undescribed reptile. He didn't say plesiosaur. He said undescribed reptile, which left that door open. And then there was the ichthyologist, not Fujio Yasuda, the guy that took the pictures, but I can't remember their names. Anyway, this other ichthyologist said that he thought, based on the measurements, that the rear appendages were in too posterior position to be a match with any known species of fish. Now, that's not much, but that's two of the scientists that wrote the scientific papers that said, well, we're not sure. So you can take that for what it is, but that's what I was talking about. You know, there is just a small, tiny residue of questioning. Not much, but.
Yeah, I tend to write that one off as a shark.
Yeah, well, most people do, and I understand why. You know, most of the evidence points in that direction. However, I do take a contrary stance, you know, sometimes to my detriment.
Well, I hope you're right and I'm wrong.
Well, it's at this late date, I doubt we're going to have any kind of a breakthrough. So, but getting back to the idea about there being similar monsters in the panhandle of Florida, why don't you tell the audience about the Thomas Helms sighting of Fort Walton?
Well, now that was just weird. That was back 1940-41, I think, or it was during the war. And Helm had been let out of the Navy as an invalid after being shot by a Zero at Pearl Harbor as he fought it with a rifle, which is sort of an amazing story for anybody. What he and his wife described from their sailboat was a long neck, not very long, a few feet at least, with a round head on top that was flattened, not like a seal, but he described it as looking mostly like a giant cat, earless cat head might look. And I never know what to do with these outliers. You know, nobody else has reported exactly the same thing ever, as far as I can tell. So it's just out there. You know, it seems to be a decent a sighting in good conditions by a fairly well-qualified observer, and you just don't know what to do with it. It, you know, it just goes into a file.
Yeah.
Marked
pending. The closest thing I could think to match up with that would be Odeman's hypothetical long-necked seal would be the closest I could come to trying to identify that.
Well, that takes us back to the beginnings of modern attempts to collate and understand and try to figure out if a sea serpent was real, what is it? And Odeman's, as I recall, shoved everything into this one rather silly-looking, super long-tailed, long-necked seal. Like I said, it's just a mystery, and likely it'll always be.
Are you familiar with the Santa Clara incident off the Carolinas in 1947.
Yes.
What's your opinion on that?
I think that's another one that's in the unexplained file right now. I mean, they described that they had run over something brown and about 60 feet long. And, you know, obviously there was a lot of thrashing and spray and so forth. And they might have been mistaken on some of the details. But from the report itself, as it stands, nothing stands out as, oh, this was a whale, oh, this was a squid. So, yeah. You know, it is a little bit mysterious. And the most frustrating thing with sea serpents, of course, is the way the reports, or at least the good reports, tail off as you get into the modern era.
Yeah.
And you can say that's, well, ships are faster. Ships very rarely have lookouts. Or don't have the kind of lookouts they used to because they got radar and other things. But it's, I don't know, it's not looking too good. But I think there is still, like I said, in the eel or eel-like fish idea, I think there is a decent possibility there is still something hiding under all the legends.
Hopefully, yes. Now, one thing that has persisted up to the modern time that is very intriguing are these constant discoveries of new species of Big 12. You want to talk about that a little?
Oh, gosh. I think we have three species just in this century. Beaked whales are a really interesting analog, you know, if you're talking about big unexplained creatures. Now, part of it is because you can have it beached right in front of you, and some of them are so similar to other species that they take a long time for experts to look at the teeth and the DNA and all the rest and say, oh, this isn't True's beaked whale, this is Sowerby's beaked whale, or this is one we haven't seen before. The I think there are probably a half dozen species that are basically just known from strandings initially. Nowadays there are a lot more sightings at sea because cetologists look for them. But the really cool one was Berardius minimus, which is Japanese fishermen off the east coast of Hokkaido had always known there was one beaked whale that looked darker than the others. They called it the raven. But nobody really had an idea it was a different species until one stopped up on a beach in Alaska. And that was a really cool sort of chain of events you can trace. You know, a high school teacher, science teacher saw it. He didn't know what it was. He called a seal biologist he knew and described it to her. And she didn't know what it was. And she called a cetologist. And you know, everybody looked at the pictures and it was like, no, this doesn't look right. It doesn't look like anything. And they were eventually able to find some other strandings and match them up. In fact, one, there was a skeleton of it hanging in a high school gym in Alaska. And everybody just assumed it was some known species. So that's just a fascinating example. And I have talked to a lot of cetologists because I've done paper and other things on whale tracking the last few years. And nobody thinks that all the beaked whales are necessarily accounted for.
And we must emphasize, these are air-breathing animals.
Yep, they have to come to the surface. Even if they like deep water and they dive a lot. You know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so this kind of puts the kibosh on the idea that, oh, if there were unknown air-breathing animals, we'd know about them. I guess not.
It does introduce an element of doubt. You know, you can't say categorically that there's nothing, you know, that we know there is nothing like that out there.
So what is your opinion on the possibility of there being unknown populations of coelacanths that we don't know about spread over the ocean?
Oh, I think that's highly likely. I mean, you had the first catch off South America, and then you had them in and around Madagascar. And much later, they, for a long time, it was thought the South African one was a stray, and it turns out no, there are more on the African coast. And then that fortuitous discovery by two scientists walking by a fish market in Indonesia that led to the third population. And I don't remember if you were at the cryptozoology conference that was in St. Augustine a few years ago.
No, I knew about it.
Someone described a so far fruitless, you know, search for more coelacanth populations, but you're stretching an awful long ways from South Africa to Indonesia, you know, thousands of kilometers, and it's hardly unlikely that there are more populations like that.
Well, the way I've read it in the scientific literature, the theory is that the reason the Komodo species and the Indonesian species got split apart millions of years ago is by the fact that the continent of India was moving north, and one population wound up on one side of the moving continental plate and the other one wound up on the other side, and that's why they diverged.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So the most conservative people seem to think that probably your most fruitful areas to look for unknown large marine animals are in the beaked whales, unknown types of sharks, giant jellyfish, and cephalopods. What do you think of that?
I think that's a pretty good list. I think there is no way we know all the sharks. I mean, the first shark book I read when I was a kid, it was like there were 200 species, and just a decade or so ago, there were 350, and now we're sort of somewhere north of 500. Of course, the new ones are mostly, you know, small, deep water creatures you wouldn't think of as being sharks at all. But I would not at all rule out there's a couple of sizable sharks left to find. What's the second one you mentioned?
Jellyfish.
Oh, well, you mentioned beaked whales, and as I said, there were I don't think anybody feels sure we've gotten all of them. I had that fortuitous little bit in the two books I wrote that in 95 I talked to a scientist named Karen Forney, who described a beaked whale that didn't match any of the classifications. And I talked to her again in 2005, you know, when it had been found beached and had been classified. And that was sort of very cool. So there may be more of those. I also don't know what to think of Wilson's whale, to go off on a tangent for a moment.
Sure.
I have asked if that was a blackened whale with a little bit of white showing and a very tall, thin dorsal fin that Edward Wilson painted from life in about 1902.
Now, is this the one that has a head like a sperm whale or a pygmy sperm whale, but a dorsal fin like an orca?
Yeah, it's kind of a blunt head and a very tall, narrow dorsal fin. And I thought it was probably the very rare, one of the rare orchids. I forget if type C or D is the rarest one down there, because it's got small spots and other less identifying features than most orcas. But I've talked to a couple of the cetologists who are real experts on coral whales, and they say Wilson's whale was too far south. They don't go into waters that cold. So who knows? Jellyfish. The jellyfish one is interesting because it basically comes down to one report, doesn't it? The one about the ship that got one stuck on its bow, basically.
Oh, the Kuranda. I've heard the story. Yes.
Yeah, and did he?
Well, in 1989, there was a giant purple jellyfish that was completely unknown that was discovered, I think, in the Sea of Cortez. Called Chrysaora, which is a genus that's very well known, but this was an unknown species of giant purple jellyfish. I mean, the bell was huge. It's like, I don't know, 8 feet wide, something like that.
The species you're thinking of, I think the bell is only about a meter wide, but there just isn't much to go on. There's an old clipping of the newspaper account of the Australian incident, and there's just not much there. Now that we could still find some large oceanic jellyfish, yes, that wouldn't surprise me. But I don't think there's evidence for monsters. I mean, something with essentially no brain can only coordinate itself up to a certain size.
Well, now speaking of brains, cephalopods appear to be some of the most intelligent animals in the ocean.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be surprised at all to learn there are a lot of large cephalopods that we haven't found yet.
Definitely there are a lot we haven't found. How big they are, nobody knows. I don't think we have good evidence for giants ever since we got all of cryptozoology got disappointed by the St. Augustine carcass being identified. But there are some reports of really, really big ones, and you don't know. I mean, cephalopods are still very weird to us. A lot of people have made the remark that it's almost like an alien intelligence. They're just fascinating creatures. People like Dana Staff, STAAF, have been writing books on recently on how smart they are and how clever they are when they're set with a problem.
Yeah. So what is your take on the Gloucester sea serpent, the famous New England sea serpent case?
Well, I know we had a bunch of sightings, totaling easily 100 plus witnesses in that area, around 1817. And I don't think that one has been entirely explained. There are individual reports that when you look at them, the one that's, there's one I was reading this morning where he said, well, there were 50 loops of it above the surface. No, come on, that's got to be a school of something else. But there are some. There is a new book breaking it down as being mostly large fish snagged in fishing gear, but the book's ridiculously expensive, so I don't have it.
By Robert France. I know the book you're
that
referring.
One. Yes. Yes, I have not read that. I'm waiting for a used copy to show up somewhere.
He's written several papers also about the idea of large sea turtles getting caught in fishing gear and being mistaken for monsters. Like the conrit might be a turtle with fishing gear all over it.
Yeah, one of the hardest things... I'm sorry, please go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was saying one of the hardest things to do if you're attempting any analysis of any possibility that some creature we call the sea serpent exists is that so many of the good sightings are so old.
Yeah.
I don't think the whole Gloucester thing has been entirely explained. There are some weird ones in there. Even Ellis said, and of course this was a couple of decades ago, but even Ellis said that it's hard to believe something unusual wasn't going on.
Yeah. We were talking about the Valhalla sighting as being the gold standard of sea serpent reports. Well, from my own personal perspective, having talked to Marvin McCamus, who was a pilot for the Alvin submersible, and him telling me about his sea monster encounter in the Bahamas in 1965 is one of the most impressive cases.
It's an intriguing case.
Yeah.
I mean, you had, for a while there was nothing except, and I forget the sequence where books came out, but in Victoria Cajal's book on Alvin, he just says, you know, I saw 40 or 50 foot of a monster and didn't say anything yeah. else about it.
Yeah.
And then in Charles Bowitz's, one of Charles Bowitz's books on the Bermuda Triangle, you know, there was a much more detailed account where it was clearly yeah. a plesiosaurus type of animal.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know. Again, I have no reason to doubt the man's honesty.
Yeah. But, you know, unfortunately, I wish I had a transcript or a recording of the phone conversations that we had back in the 90s, but I don't. You know, all I can say is that I spoke to the man, and he said that Berlitz was wrong about it, the date, 1969, because the Alvin had been sunk and was unavailable in that year. But he said the year was 1965, but that the bulk of what he said in the Berlitz book is accurate, that it did look like a plesiosaur.
Remind me how deep that was, though. It seemed awfully deep for a...
Oh, I can't remember. They were down inspecting an underwater listening array that the Navy had called Artemis.
Yeah.
And I can't remember off the top of my head what the depth was, but it was deep. It was in a place called the Tongue of the Ocean.
Yeah.
Very close to Andros Island. But
yeah,
I can't remember the depth. Let me open up my PDF and I'll tell you if it says about the depth. Hang on.
Okay.
Should come up on it pretty soon.
Yeah, 5,000 feet. It's really hard to believe a plesiosaur had any business down there.
Well, the thing is,
alive.
There's evidence of decompression syndrome on fossil plesiosaur back vertebrae. So they know they were deep diving. And they know that leatherbacks and elephant seals can dive.
Yes.
Yeah. It says 5,000 feet here. Yeah.
But what does the other man on board say? Has anybody ever tracked down, Captain Bill Rainey?
He's dead. He died in 1985.
Okay.
So he'd been dead for 12 years before I ever contacted McCamus. And how I contacted McCamus is there used to be a thing called Yahoo People. We could punch in a name and it would give you a list of people with that name and their phone numbers. And just on a lark, I punched in Marvin McCamus and come up with like three of them. And I called each one. I said, you know, are you Marvin McCamus, the former pilot for the Alvin submersible? And finally, this one in Port St. Lucie, Florida said yes. And I said, I told him who I was. And I says, look, I want to ask you about this alleged encounter you had with a sea monster on the Alvin. And he told me the whole thing. Absolutely blew my mind. And the coolest thing I have is a Christmas card from him from Christmas of 1997. And I was able to look at his handwriting in the Christmas card and find another sample of his handwriting from some kind of Alvin related article, and they matched. So there you go. That's the best proof I have, you know. You can either say I'm telling the truth or call me a liar, but that's the truth.
Yeah, and again, I don't call him a liar, but it's weird where details sort of get added afterwards. Like maybe your mind's filling them in. Maybe you saw a big leatherback turtle at a depth where you absolutely didn't expect it.
Well, one of the things he said was that it resembled a swimming utility pole. So that would seem to imply that it had a really, really long neck and was kind of long and thin. But the other thing he told me was that after they saw it through the porthole, they tracked it on sonar for a short period, and then it was gone.
I hadn't heard that either.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, it's one of those reports, it's like Helms, it's just out there. Nobody else is going to see a plesiosaur, you know, deep under the water ever.
Yeah. Well, as unlikely as some people think the idea is, one thing to consider is that outside of sea turtles, all these Mesozoic marine reptiles gave live birth in the water. So they wouldn't be tied to coming up close to shore and crawling up on the beach to lay eggs.
Now, right, we know now they didn't.
That's a small factor, but it is something to consider that if there is a population of these animals we don't know about, they could be reproducing out at sea in the deep water. We just don't know if it's possible.
They could, and I know I'm coming up on the end of your time here, I think.
We can go as long as you want to.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's no problem. Yeah.
You know, what I come down to, and I've quoted this a lot, but nobody put this well as Richard Ellis did a long time ago, which is, if I were a betting man, I would bet against such a thing existing, but I would be delighted to lose my money.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, time will tell, you know?
Yeah, if eventually we are going to know more and more of the deep sea fauna and the, you know, we had this census of marine life, this decade-long effort that just dumped thousands of new species into our laps, mostly little invertebrates, but not all. So I don't think anybody thinks we know all the fish or all the cephalopods.
So having been in the Air Force, what is your opinion on UFOs?
Oh, that goes back a ways. If I was to say that best way I can put it is that have people seen things that are still unidentified? And yes, they have. Is there concrete evidence that aliens have ever set foot here? No, there isn't. You know, I do tend, gosh, what was his name? Fellow with Aviation Week. Big skeptic on UFOs. Wrote a book suggesting that there were larger, more long-lived equivalents to ball lightning that formed sometimes in the sky. And that actually would explain quite a few of them. So I don't know. You know, there's zero evidence that anybody can point to as hard evidence, you know, that an alien has ever dropped in. But there are individual unsolved sightings.
Was there a time when you were younger that you were much more sympathetic to the idea?
Oh, of course. You know, I grew up thinking all of these things, so whether it was sea serpents or aliens or whatever, you know, were real things.
Yeah.
So you get more nuanced as you get older.
Yeah. Well, of course. I've done that myself. What is your opinion on the possibility of relic hominoids?
It is possible. It is extremely unlikely that, you know, they're in North America and nobody can get a piece of one. Nobody can get find a dead one or get a, sooner or later, you know, one is going to get hit by a logging truck or shot by a deer hunter or whatever. And it's just a decade, as every decade passes with nothing new, just more of the same, it seems to me that the possibility diminishes more and more until you get like Nessie, where I think the possibility is diminished to zero. Now, that's not to say there are no big primates left at all. I think the Orang Pendek in Sumatra and surrounding areas has a very good chance of being a real primate. What, I don't know. But that is, that's certainly the most likely, in my mind, of all the hominids or primates that have been put forward.
Well, why don't you tell us about your fiction books? Give us some background information on those.
Well, I've always liked writing fiction, but I never sold anything, and I got off on the nonfiction first, and then I sort of circled back around. And I wrote The Dolmen, Dolmen being an English megalithic tomb, for those who haven't heard the term much. I got back, came up with that one because I thought, how would you write an old-fashioned, you know, creatures chasing people, people chasing creatures, with a brand new, with a creature nobody's ever done before? And so I came up with The Dolmen, which is using Corrigans, which are creatures from English legend, and there's about a dozen kinds of things labeled with that name, but, you know, I picked the ones I wanted. And, you know, loose in modern Los Angeles, and it was just a lot of fun. It was fun to put yourself in the position of these things that had woken up from a from an illegally imported English megalithic tomb. I think the moral of the story is, if you're going to import something like that, you ought to sift through the dirt, because you don't know what eggs or what other kind of status something very strange could theoretically be in. And I lived in Los Angeles for 5 years. I went to college at USC. And it was just really fun to visit all the old haunts and put monsters in them. And to think about, okay, these things just woke up. There's only a handful of them. They're in an environment they don't recognize at all. You know, they're blundering around. They're smart. They're at least chimp level smart, but they're blundering around here in this weird thing. And when one of these tall primates sees them, the only thing they can think of is, oh, we've got to kill that one. And that was just a ton of fun to write.
And I imagine you had to put in a lot of work to make a realistic theory background to make it plausible, to sell it.
And of course, that's fun. You know, I love doing research. A couple of biologists read it and said, yeah, this more or less works. And of course, the amazing artist, Bill Rebsamen, I think we only went through two or three drafts of the cover of what one of these things looked like against the Los Angeles skyline. It's a wonderful cover. And yeah, I'm still very proud of it.
Yeah, well, I read it and I liked it too. So, and I actually liked your Lake Iliam the Dunkleosteus book too. So I'm hoping at some point you get that out.
I will. It's just a question of picking which opportunity, and of course finding the opportunity. And of course there are things you do now that you're trying to be sensitive. There are challenges to fiction writers because, you know, this is an area where all of the inhabitants, or most of them, are Alaska natives from four tribes. So you want to find someone in. That's where the power of the internet helps writers so much, is that you can find people, you know, from who are you pick or whatever, who will read it for you and say, yeah, this guy got us right.
Yeah.
But that one was an awful lot of fun because, you know, you're reconstructing the food chain and the lifestyle. And one of the things that always bugs me about some prehistoric creature thrillers is it just sort of shows up and you don't know where it's been. And you can work out some of the good dunk fossils are from Alberta, and some of them are from Ohio. And you can sort of work out a migration in stages, where they would have gotten into the Gulf of Alaska, and then the new predators, you know, things like orcas,
yeah,
sort of bottled them up.
Well, now, have you used any speculative evolution to change your modern hypothetical Dunkleosteus from what we know in the fossil record as they are in your book?
Well, creatures, fish that become, that make the transition from salt to freshwater, and there's quite a few that do, they tend to become smaller. And it's not a hard rule, you know, it's not an unbreakable rule. But we have at least one, we have one Dunkleosteus in the Cleveland Museum that's estimated at almost 29 feet long. It depends sometimes how you think the tail is structured, but, you know, is in the orca size range. And I just thought it was more practical for these creatures in a lake where the food is there, but it's seasonal, and they have to sort of adapt to low food periods, that they would get a little smaller.
Well, a 5-foot Dunkleosteus would be terrifying, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it would.
It could put some hurt on you, definitely. What do they call it? The staple pulled from hell?
That was another line from Richard Ellis that I've been shamelessly stealing ever since. It looks like a giant staple remover.
Yeah. Well, that's what they look like. The only thing I can think that has a comparable head that's alive now is an alligator snapping turtle.
Yeah, that's not a bad analogy. You don't have actually the biting plates fitting into each other, but yeah, I've seen alligator snapping turtles, and man, they are mean.
Yeah, absolutely.
You don't mess with them unless you want to leave a piece of your hand behind.
Yeah, you know what happens? These guys that go noodling for catfish in Oklahoma, every once in a while, one will get a snapping turtle on their hand. Bad news.
Yeah, there are a couple of box fish and African fish that have adopted to some degree armor, but nothing like the placoderms did. Nothing like this massive, you know, 2-inch thick armor over the whole head and the forebody. It's just sort of, it's just an amazing creature. There just was nothing like it.
Well, yeah, it's almost like the external skeleton of insects, sort of.
Kind of, because you did have that, you know, the head armor being basically the skull. The brain, they think, was just had sort of cartilage protective capsule with its own suspension ligaments or whatever, cushioned.
Didn't they have a hinge at the back of the head like a coelacanth?
Yeah, there's a cephalothoracic joint between the head and the back armor, and it let the thing open its jaws very wide and open and close them very fast, and the cheekbones had muscles that would spread them outwards, so you had a suction effect. So if this thing was close to you, forget it.
And the bottom jaw was hinged in the middle, kind of like a shark jaw, right?
A little. It's hinged forward of where you'd normally see a bony fish jaw hinged. So, yeah, there was I called it the original apex predator, the hypercarnivore, that it fed on anything it wanted, nothing fed on it.
Yeah.
Just fascinating.
I can't see how anything could have got through that armor.
And now, if a shark or something could damage it aft of the armor, of course, but that assumes that you lived long enough to get that close. Now, Lee Hall, who is a curator who just left the Cleveland exhibit, where he was an expert on these things, says there are a couple of individual bones that indicate that the 29-foot specimen was not at the top of the charts. Most of them, most dunks that have been found, most adult dunks are like, 19, 20, 21 feet. They're about the size of modern great white sharks. But there were definitely some outliers.
So you think it's possible they might have got 40 feet or close to it?
Little 30s, maybe. Like 10 meters.
Yeah, okay.
Most of them were probably down like 7 or 8 meters.
Yeah. I would imagine they were probably territorial, too, and there was probably a lot of infighting.
We don't know about territorial. We do know that there have been boluses. They tended to spit out, the undigestible parts of things with other dunks and, dunk plates that have been cut through by other dunks. There is, they didn't fight continually. There are not a lot of armor plates showing that kind of scratching, but apparently they were opportunistic. If you came along a smaller one, okay, that was lunch.
Yeah, so they were definitely cannibalistic on occasion.
Yeah.
All right, is there any last minute thoughts you want to add before we wrap it up or anything?
I don't think that that there's any new sightings or whatever I want to throw in, but the ocean, we love that it is mysterious. And we have, you'll hear sometimes that, we've explored 2% of the ocean or 5%. What that actually means is that 2% of the bottom has been seen by cameras or by human eyes. You can't really put a figure on how much you've explored of a giant, rolling, moving body of 1.39 million kilometers of water. There could still be some surprises out there, and we like to think that there are some spectacular ones. There may or may not be spectacular creatures out there, but there are definitely unknown creatures.
Well, and I would imagine that the really large, interesting animals that we're looking for are living in the mid-waters, not on
could
the bottom.
Could be.
Yeah.
Could be. I mean, you get into food webs and so forth, and sleeper sharks can make business on the very bottom out of fallen whales and fish and crabs and so forth.
And you've got whole food chains that aren't dependent on photosynthesis, like the black smokers, the vent fauna.
Yeah, that's very interesting
stuff. Living around them that we don't know about.
We're still finding new types of, smokers and vents and so forth.
Yeah.
And, just bursting with life that nobody has seen before. That's a fascinating area of research.
Absolutely. And we didn't know about it until 1977.
Yeah. And then it was by accident.
Yeah. Thank God for Bob Ballard.
Yeah. Well, the Alvin and Ballard and Cameron has funded so much of this stuff.
Yeah.
It's just great. And I published in the blog the other day, one of the, Kathy Sullivan, who used to be head of National Oceanic and Atmospheric administration had pulled off a double that nobody had done before. She had gone 600 kilometers above the Earth in space, and then she rode a submersible down to, was it, it was 35,000 feet plus, but it was about 10 kilometers.
Yeah,
you know, to the very bottom.
A lot of people don't realize how deep the ocean is. The Challenger Deep is 6 miles deep.
Mm-hmm.
Just staggers the mind.
Yeah, we can't really picture that.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of exploration yet to be done.
Absolutely. And
we're going to find some things.
Yep. I encourage the exploration of the oceans and space too. So.
Yeah, they're similar in some ways in that the environments are very different, but they're both extremely hostile.
Yeah.
Somebody had the great illustration that if you are at the Titanic's depth, which is 12,000 something, I think, there's an Empire State Building made of solid lead sitting on your head.
Yeah, just the amount of pressure is just staggering to imagine. That's doing deep sea exploration. That's what you're fighting, is the water pressure.
Yeah, the environment wants to kill you.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, I guess we'll wrap it up if you want to. Thank you for coming on.
Well, thank you very much. And I suppose since a lot of cryptozoology fans follow your podcast, you know, I'm always willing to trade research with, you know, somebody who's found something new or needs help on something I might have handy.
Yeah.
Because one of the great things about this community, I don't call myself a cryptozoologist anymore. There's just too much baggage attached to that.
I totally understand that.
People supporting each other and exchanging information and so forth, you know, is one of the good things.
Yes. All right. You have a nice day, and thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me on, and I'm always willing to come back again and talk
Absolutely.
Some more.
Yeah, take care.
Radio brings you The Haunted Sea with host Scott Martis.